Welcome, dear listeners, to episode 3 of the Jacobs Podcast. That small snippet was from G.A.R. Radjier with a song, Thinking of You. In this episode, friend and founder of Wig Capital Management, Jordan Shopov, joins me once again, and we tackle the issue of what I wish I knew in my 20s. We first start off with a slight detour, though, talking a bit about technology. Do you have anything you wish you knew in your 20s? Please, a reminder to get in touch. Drop me a line on my website at seanjacobs.com.au. Thanks very much, and we hope you enjoy the episode. Okay, well, Jordan, welcome back to episode 3 of the Jacobs Podcast.
Thanks very much, Sean. Good to be here again.
Excellent. Now, I know we're going to tackle today the subject, what I wish I knew in my 20s, but before we get into that, I just thought I would mention a bit of correspondence that we've got. We've got a bit of feedback coming in, which is just fantastic. But I just want to pull out a bit of coro that I had, some email that incoming just last night. And one was from an older gentleman who's about 61 or just over 60. But he noted he's, you know, very interested in launching his own contribution to public affairs, and he wants to launch his own website. And he was very inspired by the Jacobs Podcast. But I couldn't help but think it's how it just really drives home how people of all ages are actually have got this hunger to contribute to public discussion. You know, it doesn't matter if you're 60 or if, you know, half that, you're our age 30 or you're a teenager. There's this massive hunger there for contributing to public discussion. And I think it's just amazing that he's doing his own website because the tools really are there. And one of the things I mentioned back to him was just the capacity of a podcast to really reach a lot more people than writing. So I suggested that to him. But I just thought that was some good feedback to mention there.
Yeah, and kind of it just goes to show that, you know, everyone is unique in their own way and has something to contribute. You might not know what it is, but, I mean, everyone's got their own specialty or their own interests, and you'd be surprised who's interested in what you have to say. And, I mean, it's fun trying to contribute. I mean, we're enjoying what we're doing. So, yeah, everyone, I mean, well, if people are keen, yep, they should definitely get up and have a crack.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I mentioned, we're going to cover what I wish I knew in my 20s, but I just want to try and introduce a rank punditry element, if I can, to this podcast and just quickly ask you before we move on to that topic. Is there anything in the news, Jordan, that's caught your eye recently or any articles that you've read that you'd like to share with listeners that are worth a mention at all?
Anything in the gossip rags?
Columns.
Yeah. Nothing of note, but I did have one experience last week, which I might share. It was more an observation, actually, but I thought maybe, I thought I saw something quite unique and I was keen to get your thoughts on it. So I was in Sydney for a conference last week. It was just a day trip up and back. And, as you do, you've landed from your flight and you're making your way to the baggage claim area. And like everyone does, they usually have to go through one or two sets of escalators. And, I don't know about you, Sean, but I always make a beeline for the stairs. I never go for the escalator. And this was, I've been doing that for years just because, you know, my thinking is that I can get a bit of exercise or, you know, I don't, you know, I'd rather just, you know, carry my bags. I'm not really too phased. But it was the first time this time sitting there watching and I realized, you know, I'm going faster than up the stairs on my own than everyone else who's sitting on the escalator. And you're like, hold on. Everyone, I mean, this is such an obvious thing to point out, but it's like everyone is sitting or standing on the escalator, not moving. And I was reflecting on the fact that technology is like an escalator, whether it's flat or stairs. They're all designed to improve our productivity, improve our efficiency. But for some reason, this technology is actually making people lazier and less productive. Like, if you thought about it rationally, everyone who stands on an escalator should be walking at their normal pace. The idea is that these things are meant to speed up the time it takes for you to get from A to B. I mean, everyone is in the airport is not there for a leisure ride. It's not the royal show. You're not there to jump on the Ferris wheel. Everyone is there because they're in transit to somewhere else. So hypothetically or, you know, theoretically, you'd say that everyone should be moving as fast as they can. And if you've got something there to aid you, why wouldn't you just be walking at your normal pace? And it made me think, what other pieces of technology are out there where even though they have well-intentioned and should improve our productivity are actually making us lazier?
Yeah. No, look, it's a good point. Just to clarify, was it an actual escalator or was it one of those ones that Sydney Airport, so they're all flat there, aren't they? They're just the flat ones that people walk on and they just push you along, right?
Yeah, and there was, I think, one stair one at the end, but the flat ones I find even worse. Like, it's even more obvious that, you know, you can get to your destination faster. I mean, it's just, it's the same, the ground underneath you is not changing at all.
Yeah.
So, I just don't understand why people would get on an escalator and then sit there like it's, you're on a show ride. And it made me think, it doesn't necessarily mean that technology or that certain innovation is, problematic or evil or is giving us the wrong incentives. I think it says more about human nature and maybe even society more broadly that we've gotten to a point where we treat these innovations as, as like indulgences or luxuries rather than for their actual intended purpose.
Yep.
I was keen to see if you, am I going crazy here or you think that's bizarre as well?
No, look, I don't think you're going crazy. It's quite interesting you mention it, actually, because at the end of the last podcast, you talked about Niall Ferguson and the square and the tower. And one of the notes he makes in that, and we didn't quite touch on it, but he makes a really strong point about social media. And, that's obviously very tech-heavy, but it's something that's well-intentioned. It's designed to make us connect. It's designed to make us more productive and efficient. But I do think that it does actually make things, it cocoons people in a way. And I do think it does make people, I think, probably lazy, just like the travelator, too, where you think with virtue signaling, it's like, well, look, I posted something on, World Wildlife Fund or a Greenpeace post. Therefore, I have some sort of moral authority. When we know in reality, in day-to-day life, that's not really, a post like that isn't something that just gives you moral validity. I'm not drawing too long a bow there, but it's just, or as well, like how it actually cocoons people. This is something that Niall Ferguson makes the point of. You have, you're only seeing, because of how the algorithms are on social media, you're only seeing really a lot of the stuff that people agree with you on. So you've got this really narrow-casted mindset. So, it's a very well-intentioned thing. You're connecting people. You're supposed to be expanding horizons, getting new ideas. And when in reality, you're actually only getting slices that the algorithms made you, like cocooning you in terms of what you're clicking and what you're actually exploring the stuff you're commenting on as well. Yeah.
And you end up, you're just generating noise. You're not necessarily creating a meaningful signal. It's just, getting washed around with a whole bunch of other irrelevant comments. And I think you could also draw that back into, looking at the phone itself. I mean, if you'd said 100 years ago to someone that you'll have a device that you can fit in your pocket with all the world's information accessible at the click of a finger, people would think, oh, my God, the amazing things that people could do. And yet we end up sitting here, looking at cat videos. And, I don't think that's an indictment on Apple. I mean, I don't know about Facebook and how they all run their algorithms. They might have a bit more culpability. But, these innovations have huge productivity potentials, but we don't seem to be. I think it's more an indictment on, modern culture that we aren't using them to their full potential. Anyway, that's just something that struck me during the week and I wanted to share with you.
Yeah, sure. Look, it's a great point, and again, I hope it wasn't the listeners drawing too long a bow there. But I think there's good intentions of tech, and it's probably something we want to explore in a future episode for sure. There's some really good, well-intended things, but end up sort of deviating a bit and actually exercising some bad elements. And I suppose every innovation is like that. It can exacerbate a lot of bad elements of human behaviour, but the broad argument could be made that we're moving forward. Therefore, we're enjoying, we're living longer, we're healthier, all that sort of thing. And it's a really interesting, fascinating discussion as well. So, it's a good observation, Jordan. I like it.
Hopefully, I'll bring another one next week.
No, that's good. That's good. Yeah. Look, we'll like to change gears now. I think we'll just move straight into the thrust of what the topic is we wanted to cover and what I wish I knew in my 20s. So just straight off the bat, Jordan, what jumps out to you is, both of us are just out of our 20s. Looking back in your 20s, what's the first thing that jumps out to you? What is the number one thing you wish you knew when you're in your 20s?
Yeah, I'll start. I've got three sort of broad categories. One's career focused, the other one's happiness, and the last one's on decision making. So, but I'll start with career. This one jumped out at me. It's actually quite fun reflecting on these things now. I mean, there's not too many things that we can give, you know, worldly advice on. So, you know, the fact that we have reached a certain age bracket, you've got to take advantage of it. So, yeah, let's let's give it to the 20-year-olds.
Good point.
And the one on career, the thing that I wish I knew when I was starting out or leaving school was that you should be competing to be different, not to be the best. And it took me years to figure that out. And one person that helped me see the light was Peter Thiel, the first outside investor in Facebook, author of a great book called Zero to One. He's a venture capitalist and was the first founder in, was one of the founders of PayPal along with Elon Musk, and worked alongside guys like Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn. So an incredibly intelligent, successful guy. And listening to his story, I could identify myself with a lot of his trajectory. And he talked about feeling like he was always on this hyper-tracked path, whether it's through school and through uni. And when he finished high school, someone wrote in his yearbook, I know that you'll get into Stanford, and then 5 years later you get into Stanford Law. And he did. It was like there was a certain level of inevitability about his life, and it was because he was so focused on winning the contest that everyone else was participating in. He was competing to be the best at what everyone else was doing, but not trying to be different, not competing to be unique, to sort of take his own path. And that, you know, I've felt that a lot with my education. I was so focused on getting a good score after year 12, and then you know, wanted to get into the best program, didn't think why I was doing it, and then after that, you know, wanted to get into a great grad program. And it was kind of like, you know, the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and again and wondering why nothing different is happening. I was like, why do I feel completely unfulfilled at each stage? And it was because I was just doing what everyone else was doing. You might think you're doing something different, or you're trying to, you know, being better than everyone at something makes you unique, but it doesn't. It just makes you sort of part of the same mass. And so it made me, like, that piece of advice from Thiel was sort of about asking why you're doing something, and making sure you're differentiating yourself, just like a company would. Like, the most successful companies don't try and do what everyone else is doing, because that turns into a commodity product. And I think the way that the education system is geared is that we end up coming out like commodity products. We're not fully exploiting each of our eccentricities and uniqueness.
Sure. So, and Jordan, just quickly on that one, I think it's obviously risky to try and you know, differentiate yourself to be, you know, not just be competitive to be the best, but to differentiate yourself. It's obviously something that's really risky and hard to just do, because we're conditioned so much to live a sort of very trapped lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, and it's kind of great into you in your younger years. I mean, you want to fit in. Everyone wants to be popular. Everyone wants to have friends, and so, you know, that's part of the socialization process as you're growing up. But there's a point where you kind of have to almost revert back to like a childlike state, where you follow the things that, you know, only a child would be interested in, like those, you know, whether it was doing drawings or playing sport or just the things that you intuitively embrace as a child. You know, your natural curiosity is boundless. And it's funny, as you get older, people stop you doing the right thing because it's unconventional, and they don't mean to. It's just part of the nature of, I think it's just part of human nature that we, you know, we have always survived in groups, and that group mentality starts to weigh on you, and that peer pressure can, you know, take you away from what might be your true path. And I think, just to take that one step further, like, you know, obviously competing to be different means that you want to sort of create your own vocation, your own unique mark on an industry. And that's not going to happen by just doing something because it's everyone else is doing it. Or, you know, I'm going to be a lawyer because that's the most prestigious profession. You don't want to do something for the status. You want to be doing it for the substance. And the only way you're going to be able to take that path is if you truly embrace that inner passion. And that, I mean, like, anything, that to be good at anything, you need extreme focus, and you're more likely to be good at something, and you're more likely to have that focus if you're passionate about it. And while I'll just finish with one last anecdote on that, Steve Jobs at I think it was at Stanford, he gave a graduation speech, And he talked about when he was younger, he dropped out of uni because he felt bad for his parents who was paying for his education. He thought he wasn't getting anything out of it. But at the same time, he actually said he started dropping in on certain classes, which he thought would be more interesting. But and so one of the ones he did was a calligraphy course. And at the time, he had, no idea what that would be used for or, whether it was going to get him a job in the near term. But he was completely and utterly enthralled by the subject of calligraphy. And, years later, when he was building, I think, the first Macintosh and the word processor, a lot of the stuff he learned around calligraphy became a part of that word processor. And it was revolutionary at the time. It was part of what made Apple such a unique, groundbreaking product. And that he described that experience as connecting the dots backwards. You kind of have to take a leap of faith and, follow your passion, not knowing where it's going to lead you. And even though other people around you might think you're crazy, but following your true desires and your true interests are more likely to lead you to mastery and a more fulfilling vocation.
Yeah, sure. And look, just on that, because I think, you mentioned you had three things, but on career, I just probably might be a good chance to offer, just jump in and offer my thoughts on that one, because it can be a bit of both, I think. Following your passion, some people have started to criticise that advice a little bit and gone, if you're go climb Kilimanjaro, you don't really have a plan and you sort of flutter around a bit and you're 40 and then you don't really have any skills. And, one of the things I think as well is it can't just be this endless bonanza of following your passion. You've got to really refine it with just hard, raw skills. And, one of the things I've found, I've followed that same path as you, Prime Minister's Department, the graduate, very successful graduate program, a youth ambassador for development, done all like some very, things that I'd aimed really high for that look very good on the CV. And whilst, going back to my 20s, it might not have been the exact path I'd re-follow again. I do think that what it has given me though, although it hasn't really been, I guess it was a Teal kind of approach, like just very much focusing on getting those wins in the career, where it wasn't so much following my passion to a degree, but what it really gave me was, a real, just really refined my skills, like my writing, coordination, briefing, like being able to distill and synthesize challenges and produce outcomes, all those sorts of, generic professional skills where, if I'd just followed my passion, it might not have been, great advice to give yourself without tempering that with just going, hey, look, this really needs a lot of hard work. It can't just be a life of just indulgence, a 20s of just indulgence. And I think probably a lot of people just miss the message there. You want to still be able to follow, some sense of your passion or know what you're good at, but you've got to work really hard at it too. And I think building skills, that skill component is just really, really a critical factor in that.
I completely agree. And I think the example of, someone climbing Mount Kilimanjaro is a perfect example of people getting, that message confused. They hear passion. They think, holidays and indulgent types of indulgence.
Being just full of bravado or, swearing, like that gets, he's really passionate or she's really passionate. She swears in meetings and pounds the table. You're right.
And that's not what passion's about. Passion's about finding that state of flow when you're doing a piece of work. And, when people talk about, their passions being holidays, they're talking about this sort of work-life balance idea, which I think is a bit misleading. In the end, your work is meant to be an embodiment of who you are. And that's the real state of pleasure you get from getting a sense of productivity out of what you're doing and really, learning new skills. Like you said, you're more focused on the substance of something rather than the short-term gratifications of it. And I was always too focused on the sort of the signaling side of it. Like, what's this program going to look like for my CV? Is this program going to, get me into the right, the right circles or something? But really it's about the substance. It's about what you're going to learn and building the right skills and working for people that you admire. Because if you just spend your time trying to build up your CV, I remember Buffett saying, "So you just try and build up your CV. That's like saving up sex for your old age. You got to do what you want. You got to do what you want now. And that's not going out and partying. That's like finding a calling in life, finding a vocation that's going to make you happy.
Sure. Sure. Absolutely. And, you know, I think is that, you know, that getting out of that career criteria, moving on to the next one. What was your second criteria, Jordan?
Yeah, so the second one is on happiness, and it was my piece of advice for my younger self was to focus on building habits, not goals. And I think
and that really ties into the first, you know, the what you're saying about the process, like in the career element. You know, you're enjoying the journey, not so much the standing on the podium or the destination. It's really that flow and that sort of day to day passion.
Yeah, and I think people kind of take that piece of advice as a bit cliche. Like, you know, it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. And I used to think that, like, oh, that's a bit wanky. But the older I've gotten, the more I'm seeing the virtue and the wisdom in that statement. And it really struck me when I read a book called The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And I'm sure a lot of people have heard of that book, and it's usually in most bookstores, and I think it sold millions of copies. And I was, to be honest, I was pretty skeptical when it was handed to me. It's a self-help book, and a lot of that stuff can be quite wishy-washy and, you know, smile.
I hope you didn't think that about my book, Jordan.
Not at all. All right. I haven't read it.
Yeah. Touché.
which is a topic for another podcast. We're definitely going
to do that. Yeah. Sorry, man. I cut you off, but keep going.
So, yeah, I was pretty skeptical of this book when it was handed to me, and my brother highly recommended it. He thought it was fantastic. And, yeah, it really changed the way I thought about a lot of things I was doing. I think for some reason you grow up focused on goals, whether it's like, you know, I want to have a girlfriend, or I want to get married at this age, I want to have kids, or I want to have this much money, I want to retire at that age. And I remember having a few goals when I was younger and reaching them and feeling unsatisfied, and then if I didn't reach some, I'd be completely pissed off. And it wasn't until a few years later, and especially this reading this book, that I started to realize that's not a very fulfilling way to go about your life. And it's more about building effective habits and getting into the right routines. And the reason that is because over time your habits and those processes you get into start to reap a certain character. And your character is ultimately your destiny. Character is what's more important. It's not about your personality. It's character that shapes who you are and your legacy and how you be remembered. And that really hit home in reading the 7 Habits book when in the first chapter he talks about think about your funeral. Think about the end game where, you know, you're there in the coffin. You can see everyone who's come and you can hear what everyone's saying. What would you hope that people would get up and say about your life? Would you like people to get up and say, oh, he was abusive, you know, no one would ever say that, but, you know, was he an abusive alcoholic, or, you know, he was rude, he was always angry, or, you know, he made a lot of money, but he didn't share it with anyone. It's like, you know, no one's going to sit there and list off your degrees or how much money was in your bank account. They're going to sit there and talk about the type of person you are. And that's your character. It's your values. And so that book made me think long and hard about, you know, what values do I cherish? What do I want to be, you know, remembered for? And that's quite a personal thing. It's quite hard to think of when you haven't thought about it before. But, you know, I've read the book a couple of times and went back to it. And Stephen Covey, the author, recommends that you do kind of like a personal mission statement and flesh those things out. And I found it incredibly, incredibly useful. And it helped me sort of, you know, not only realize that I was doing some things that weren't going to make me happy, but realize new things that, you know, I actually want to strive for. So, that's my second one.
Yeah, great. And look, again, that just ties in so well to the first about, you know, building systems and, you know, finding meaning and even just having small systems. I think, you know, that about the process side of things, that day to day can be tremendously effective, you know, and goals that aren't just lines on CVs, but, you know, goals that, you know, are obviously good for you, but then also for others around you, I think your loved ones, and then a goal that engages you in its pursuit is something that's really obviously worthwhile. But then in order to do that, as I mentioned before, you've got to have really good systems and processes in place. And, you know, I think as well, that's, and you probably wanted to mention this too, but it's kind of, you know, habits are just so important to things. And sorry, you did actually mention, but habits, yeah, tremendously important to things. Not so much, passion, I suppose, or just being able to ignite yourself based on, you know, flamboyance or riding a wave, a high, because, you know, if you've got good habits, then, you know, you're able to perform, you're able to keep moving towards your goals or engaging yourself, even when you're low or when you're high as well. And one of the good things, I always remember, I think it's Steve Waugh who mentioned this, I believe it was anyway, but, you know, he's like, when you have a bad day, if you have a good day, don't get too carried away with yourself. And then the same way, if you have a bad day, don't get too carried away with yourself either. I think it's just that sort of that the habits are just that element of consistency that pulls you back in and then keeps you sort of moving forward. But then also it's just there can be a really useful way of just ordering, you know, what is, you know, essentially quite, you know, quite what can be a very crazy kind of world and tumultuous time, whether it's in your career or in your life or anything like that. If you've got good systems in place, don't discount them and how important they are. I don't think you want to be foolish about things and so unbudging about them. You've got to be agile and be able to change systems when you can and change habits when you can. But the importance of just creating good habits early, I think, is one of those things I would have said to myself in my 20s. And, that was something I really worked on, you know, hard as well when I was coming out of my teens and into my 20s, is just knowing that I was building some really good foundation stones for later in life. And I think that's probably, and I don't want to be too pretentious here, but that's a really good thing that I had, you know, put upon myself, is because I knew that these were really formative years, that if you set up bad habits and bad foundations, your trajectory is going to be all warped. So, and especially when you're so malleable, when you're in your 20s and coming out of high school and your late teens, you've got to really set those good habits and those systems for you, like for yourself early in life, so you can put your rudder on a pretty steady course.
One thing you said in there, which resonated with me, was sort of about the sort of chaotic nature of life. I think that's one thing you start to realize as you grow up. Like, it's not as, there's so much randomness out there, and there are so many things that are out of your control. I think you grow up with this false notion that you can control a lot of things in your life, and as you get older, you start to realize that's just ludicrous. And so when you live in a world that you don't really understand, that is so complex and is out of your control, habits are really the only way you can survive, and how you can, you know, deal with that uncertainty and randomness. And I think, yeah, even if it's something simple as, like, you know, get up early, make the most of your mornings, and make sure you read a couple of hours a day, or, you know, listen to people when they speak. Don't try and, interrupt them. The little things like that may seem, you know, quite irrelevant, but over time they can build up, and those habits are what lead to your character. And I think building those habits around certain values that are dear to you is very important, and also help you eventually make decisions in tough times. I remember someone saying that the reason why Buffett is so happy is not because he's rich, it's because his life choices are in complete harmony with his personal values. And, you know, that's a sign that he's developed habits and systems around things he believes important. And, you know, when someone tries to tempt him or peer pressure comes another way, he's not fazed, and he knows what's important to him. And the wealth, the great wealth that he's amassed, is more a byproduct of him sticking to his processes and you know, taking solace in what he believes. So I think that's a very powerful message on a, you know, how to become, you know, how to be happy.
Sure, that's right. And this is just a quick detour, but I do recall we discussed this not too long ago about remaining vigilant about, you know, not building bad habits, I think, as well, how important it is. Clayton Christensen, the Harvard Business School professor and innovation expert, he asks, you know, three questions, and one of to his graduate classes, and one of them is how can you ensure you'll stay out of prison? And it's sort of a bit of a crack, but he says it's not actually a crazy question, because in his Rhodes Scholar class of 32, two of his peers ended up in jail. And, you know, these are, you know, you can imagine incredibly successful people who've made, have built fantastic careers, made a lot of money, but they've sort of, something has gone wrong in terms of building poor habits, like, or just thinking, oh, just this once. And just really how vigilant you have to be about maintaining good habits and staying focused. It's Because, yeah, you're right, it is a very chaotic world. There's so many things outside your circumference of stewardship that it's very easy to get caught up. And I always think of the, you know, three examples for me, Lance Armstrong, General David Petraeus, and Tiger Woods. And, you know, again, very world-beating, successful people. But, you know, they've obviously made little decisions over time or that have had a great impact over time. You know, they've obviously got tremendously good habits and been tremendously successful. But at the same time, they've lost a bit of the capacity, or obviously lost a little bit of the capacity to not be vigilant about those good habits and systems, and then been tumbled into that chaos that is the wider world. And, you know, like, you're absolutely spot on. There's so many things that are beyond our control. And, you know, you learn, I think you probably get more conservative, and as you get older, well, you should anyway, in my view, because you realise there's so many things, yes, beyond your control, but so many things that are just a trade-off. And, you know, why things are the way they are, that, you know, a lot of things are unalterable, a lot of things have been tried before. And, yeah, I think there's a very sort of conservative message or element in that, to me anyway, about taking care of your own house, or, you know, cleaning up your own room before starting to protest in the streets, really. So some good messages there. Now, Jordan, there was a third criteria. I'm not sure if we've covered it off yet, but did you want to mention another criteria as well, what you wish you knew in your 20s?
Yeah, the last one, actually, it's a perfect segue from your story about Clayton Christensen, about how to avoid jail, because my last one is about inversion. Carl Jacobi, the mathematician, famously said, invert, always invert. And he was talking about how mathematicians very often reverse problems in order to see if they can solve it. And that might not seem like much, but the perfect example of, I mean, there's many examples of where that actually becomes a very useful problem-solving or decision-making mechanism. And one example that I love is Charlie Munger. He famously said, "All I want to know is where I'm going to die, so I never go there." And he's done a couple of speeches, I think one at Harvard and one at Stanford, to a bunch of graduates. And the first one was "The Secret to an Unhappy Life," and it was all about, you know, the types of habits or routines that would make you miserable. And the point about this is that it's sometimes easier to solve things by looking at the inverse, by doing and avoiding it. So, you know, rather than trying to come up with a grand design for your life, or, you know, come up with really positive habits, sometimes it's just enough to come up with avoiding bad ones. Like, you know, don't abuse alcohol and drugs. Don't hang around with ignorant people, or, don't carry a gun or something like that. Sometimes inverting it is a much more effective way to solve it. And another one he talks about is the sources of human misjudgment. He did a great speech on the various psychological biases and prejudices which often get investors and corporate CEOs in trouble. And it's as much about avoiding mistakes as it is about doing the right thing. Even Buffett's famous rules of investing: rule number one, don't lose money. Rule number two, don't forget rule number one. It's not about trying to maximize gains. It's about avoiding losses. And I think that idea of inversion is incredibly powerful, and something that I didn't quite resonate with me initially, but then when you start to look around, you see how it applies to a lot of things.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And there's a couple of things there that I think just are really good points for my, if I was to sort of look at decision making and invert, you know, inversion's a great point. I think, looking at things, that sort of avoiding those poor habits or being conscious of bad habits and then trying to work. So sort of, I think it's probably a glass half empty kind of approach, but it's a good way to just look at things to try and avoid. And it just, when you mentioned it, it reminded me of a point that I came across, and there was, I forget the exact statistic, but if you look at the United States, there's been done a study on this, and there's so many things that you can just do that are just so basic that just catapult your chances. Again, I forget that it was from there's a working seminar on family and American welfare policy, and I forget which group put out the paper. I think it might have been Brookings or someone like that, but they say if you actually finish high school, you try to stay employed or try to find meaningful employment. Get married early, and then if you avoid criminal behaviour, again, so you know, some Harvard Business School advice there from Clayton Christensen. But if you do those things, it's quite incredible the astronomical amount of, you know, percentage wise that you're bound to avoid long run poverty if you just do those four basic things. And you know, obviously it's a lot of, you know, it doesn't seem like tough stuff, but there's, you know, people fall down there. And I think probably just being alive to the pitfalls is probably some very decent advice to take on board, again, your late teens or coming into your 20s as well.
And I think it seems quite counterintuitive when you initially think about it, but the more you apply it, the more you see the effectiveness of it. And Nassim Taleb has pointed out that type of approach has actually been around for hundreds of years. Like the Romans described it as, they called it via negativa, and the Romans had this idea that a lot of succeeding in life was taking a subtractive approach to things. Like an example in modern terms would be, you know, removing cigarettes from your diet is better than, you know, adding broccoli to it. That's going to do more. Just discarding the bad things, or ignoring an ignorant person, is equivalent to keeping the company of a wise man. And this subtractive approach is actually, right, I think the reason it works so well, as Taleb points out, is that that's how evolution works. Evolution is not necessarily survival of the fittest. It's about discarding those traits that don't work. And it's a very bottom-up, spontaneous, letting sort of nature work its magic and, you know, making sure you avoid those perils and the traps which lead to failure. So, I've seen that even with using that approach in investing. Like, you might look at a company and, you know, the tendency is to look for all the positive things that make a company good, whether it's, you know, this is good management, it's in a growing market, it's got a, you know, it's in IT, all these, you can list off all these great things. But then if you've got one piece of negative information, which is that the accounts are fraudulent, well, that kind of trumps everything else. And so that sort of subtractive, negative way of approaching knowledge, I think, is incredibly powerful.
Yeah, sure. And look, just you can't help think, but culture is obviously subtractive too. Like, there's a lot of elements, like, you know, cultural traits that are just abandoned over time as they clash with modernity and, you know, more commercial activity, trade, the influence of outside ideas. I think that's a worthy point too, that cultures change like that as well. And I think, you know, if you look at, you know, a lot of, you know, successful cultures, they do place a premium, you know, they've got very strongly focused attitudes, priorities and behaviours on, you know, wealth creation, a very positive approach to education. You know, they're not superstitious, but, you know, very, you know, rational approach to rationality, science and facts and things like that. And I think probably, you know, to a degree, a lot of secularism too. It's like recognising, you know, there's a modern you know, like surviving or coping in the modern world requires, you know, putting superstition to one side, or emphasizing a greater individuality versus a collective sort of kinship group approach, which a lot of, you know, collective societies do. So it's quite interesting. I just thought when you mentioned that then a subtractive approach, you know, it's not just evolution, and you mentioned investing, but obviously cultures, successful cultures are like that as well.
Yeah, and they're, in many ways, they're evolutionary systems as well, because they're a function of, you know, the free bottom up exchange of ideas about morals and ethics between individuals. Like, there's no one guiding it. It's kind of like language. The language evolves in a bottom up, spontaneous way, and that's what cultures are. And they take a long time to evolve, and the changes are very gradual from our lifespan, but they're evolutionary systems. I think actually Vernon Smith won a Nobel Prize for pointing that out. He called it, I think, ecological rationality, this sort of organic, natural, subtractive approach to not only markets and economies, but to cultures as well. It applies in a lot more areas than we realise, like language and political institutions as well, I think.
Yeah, excellent. Oh, brilliant. And with the last point, one of the pieces of advice that I'd give to myself about, you know, just decision making and inversion, this branching off inversion, is I think I always return to this about eliminating ignorance. And, you know, when I was, you know, my late teens, early 20s, when I started out my professional career, so very early days when I didn't really have any proper raw skills, but I'd sort of observe people who were, you know, not world-beating champions, but who were effective in the workplace, and they'd obviously, you know, you'd watch them operate and they'd create very good systems for themselves. And I think you can get caught up and confused by looking at people who are not, you know, who are very advanced in their career. You think, well, gosh, they don't make lists, or they don't seem to be booking meetings, or, you know, spearheading things, or they seem to be so efficient and on top of things, and they don't have to do all these other little minor tasks of, you know, the hard work of calling people up, trying to track down the right people, asking the right questions to arrive at a decision or to synthesize information to arrive at an outcome. You know, and I think one of those things, I probably would have tapped myself on the shoulder when I was in my early 20s, starting out my career, just going, hey, look, you know, don't, you know, you're not better than that. You know, you've got to put in so many hard yards on these things to, again, create those really good systems. And it sounds, it's not glamorous advice, but, you know, learn as quick as you can to, you know, for not, you know, booking meetings, for example, just building those basic office skills would just get you such a head start, you know, would have got me such a head start in my career if I wasn't so ignorant of them, or just didn't take time to, you know how to properly compose a letter, doing emails, like working effectively, adding value to your senior managers in a workplace, you know, not procrastinating. You know, it's not glamorous advice, but, you know, it's one of the things I would have said to myself, you know, I'm not better than that, but, you know, that's the sort of thing I've got to work on and build those strong foundations. And I know at the start you mentioned, we both mentioned or touched on that the advice is still fresh. And, you know, that's something I always mention. I do a bit of mentoring with my old uni, Griffith Uni, and I've done it for a few years now. But I think, you know, a lot of the benefit is, you know, a lot of the other mentors, of course, are well advanced into their career, you know, decades and decades in. But it's one of the things I mention about, you know, building those skills to the people that I mentor who are really, you know, not much younger than me, is just building those skills and just trying to overcome your own ignorance, but and in a way that's not just going, oh, look, people want to work for the United Nations, how do you do that? Or, oh, you work to, you know, Department of, or, you know, for the National Security Advisor, how did you do that? This must be so cool. And it's like, okay, well, like, work backwards from that. You know, it's very nice to think about that end goal and think it's so easy, but there's just so many little skills that you need to create in the short run that you shouldn't turn your nose up at. They're really important, and that's something that I would have just told myself, again, when I was much younger or just coming into my career about 10 years ago.
Yeah, and that kind of taps into what I was saying towards the start about picking substance over status with your career. Like, you know, I think there's a tendency to think you know, obviously people are ambitious, and, you know, you and I certainly are ambitious, and I think you kind of feel that you have to go for the moonshot all in one go, but a lot of the time that's going to get you into more trouble than anything. And you're better off if you focus on a substance, you know, you adopt that substance mentality. It's about learning and working for good people, and, yeah, like you said, avoiding ignorance. And, you know, these things aren't glamorous, but cutting out bad habits and getting into good routines, it does amazing things. And it is actually fun. Like, once you get into a good system and you see what you're putting out, whether it's in terms of your reading or the relationships you build, it's, you know, this is a, you know, it's a very rewarding way to go about things, but it takes time. And I think that's the other thing. You know, this is a long game you're playing. Your 20s are so, you know, you've got so much longer to go. And I mean, people talk about retiring at 65, but I mean, that probably won't be happening in 10 or so years. And, you know, average lifespans keep going out. I mean, you can potentially, you can potentially have 50, 60 year careers. And I think the idea of working just to retire is quite limiting. If you think about your working years as years where you can achieve great things that are meaningful to you, then you want to be working as long as you can. And you know, building skills and knowledge in the early days, focusing on the substance, not the prestige of big brands or, you know, high flying executives, but on the specific thought core things that you're passionate about and want to contribute on. That's a much better path, I think.
Fair enough. Well, one of the good points my mentor said to me was, you know, I was umming and ahhing about doing, you know, about a year or 9 months in a different area that I wanted to actually work in. And he said, look, mate, you know, 1 year or 9 months out of a 50-year career is a drop in the ocean. And, you know, you might learn something later on in life, or you might carry something with you that is more useful to you later that you don't really realize, a la in that Steve Jobs sort of connecting the dots kind of way. And, you know, I've certainly, it's just sound advice that I always pass on or transmit whenever I have the chance to pass anything on. Yeah, that 1 year out of a 50-year career is not going to completely alter you. There's so much in just sticking it out and then, you know, trying to learn as much as you possibly can from a position that you probably don't enjoy too much, but that you can just sap it for all it's worth and then try use that as an example.
When you slow down a bit, it actually becomes a bit more fun. I think when you're trying to achieve too much too quickly, you're in such a rush, it can almost fly by quicker. And you can't get any more of time, so you might as well be enjoying it while you're at it. And I think, I think when people sit back and actually be honest with themselves, I think I was at one point, like, why am I in such a hurry here? And when you cut down to the reasons, you realize that's the wrong reasons. I shouldn't be, you know, I'm in a hurry because I want that status, or I want more money. But, you know, if you focus on things that are really important in the end game, you know, if you picture yourself at your funeral and think, what do I want to be remembered for? You really start to think, okay, I need to get away from these glamorous ideas and stop being in such a hurry and just take my time, take the long route, be the tortoise.
Yeah, sure. And look, that's the, it reminds me, and we'll sort of wrap up soon, I think, Jordan, very shortly, but John Bogle, it sort of brings that point that he made, that sort of two points, you know, if you want to choose the illusory rabbit of success, you know, wealth, fame and power, it's not really what it's all about. It's the real rabbit of meaning, you know, integrity. He names integrity, virtue, inner strength, and he says, heck, let's call it soul, doing our best with whatever talents that the Lord has been kind enough to endow us with. You know, he's a tremendously financially successful person, but I'd put him in the same category as someone like, you know, Buffett or Munger. He's someone who's
absolutely
done very well, but at the same time, you know, he just espouses that exact same thing that you just said then. You know, it's not about the illusory rabbit of success, but, you know, the real rabbit of meaning.
Yeah, and the irony is that if you do achieve those things, the wealth, fame and fortune usually come with it anyway. So it's an accidental byproduct of sure, you know, having the right virtues in the first place.
Sure. And Jack Bogle, he invented the index fund. Is that right?
Yeah, the first ever index fund. And, you know, a story about him. He, at the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting last year, Buffett started the conference, you know, 40,000 people at the convention center, and, you know, thousands more online. And he started off proceedings by wanting to recognize someone in the investment management industry for their contributions. And, you know, this is a guy who's dedicated his career to try to beat the market and pick stocks. And then the person he wanted to commend and got to stand up in front of everyone was Jack Bogle. And, you know, he's made a career essentially out of helping average retail investors access the market and not be screwed by stockbrokers and fund managers and all sorts. So, you know, there's sure, the things he's done, yeah, might, you know, it's not as glamorous as, you know, Buffett's wealth, but for the average person, he's done amazing things. There's plenty of people who think he should get the United States Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Yeah. Well, someone was saying, it might have been, I can't remember who it was, but it was the invention of the index fund was like the equivalent to the invention of the wheel. It's like actually quite, you know, like, yeah. And look, you know, full disclosure, I've got, you know, I'm invested in Vanguard, and it is I'm an average person. I'm not a share junk. I don't get into it in the same sort of fashion as a lot of people out there, probably like yourself, Jordan, but it's, you know, it's just such a great example. And there's probably just a good way to round out, I think, is, you know, there's a compounding interest element to what I wish I knew in my 20s. And I certainly would have, you know, invested a bit earlier. Not that I was floating in cash when I was in my teens and coming into my 20s, but you do look at what, you know, 40 years of compounding would do versus, you know, your average sort of equity fund or something like that, or even real estate. And, you know, that's something, it's so much, it's better to just get started early. And, you know, if you're 10 years in an index fund with, you know, of 10 years of compounding is just such a head start.
And that kind of ties in as well with what we were saying about inversion. Like, you know, I think people when they're young think that they can take big risks and speculate, you know, I'm only 20, I can make it all back. I've got an entire life ahead of me working. But when you're compounding money from that age for a long period of time, if you lose a small amount of money then, the opportunity cost in terms of what you could have compounded it at for 40, 50 years is monstrous. So that's another example of, like, you know, avoiding those bad speculative decisions and, you know, just letting compound interest do the work for you. It's more about avoiding the loss rather than maximizing the gain.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I think that's a really good, strong point to end on. Is there any more advice that you'd like to give yourself as Jordan Shropov 2021?
Look, he's probably already tuned out now and gone and had some beers, so I think I'll leave
that. Well, it's probably like myself, so I'd have to rest my young Sean Jr.'s little brain and just and not exhaust him too much. But yeah. No, look, this has been great, Jordan. Thanks so much for your time and offering your tips and advice. And I think, you know, as we reach a wider audience, there's definitely some reception out there for both the messages that we've had.
Thanks, Sean. As always, it was a pleasure.
Thank you, dear listeners. We hope you enjoyed episode 3, What I Wish I Knew in My 20s. A reminder to please get in touch if you have any feedback or ideas or topics for discussion at seanjacobs.com.au.